This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, Eon by Greg Baer. Copyright 1985 by Greg Baer. Narrated by James D. Lotel. This book contains 504 pages on 12 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. The stone, a huge object that is part spaceship, part asteroid, appears mysteriously in orbit around the Earth. Earthmen who undertake the exploration of the stone learn that it holds the key to the survival of the Earth, which is on the brink of a nuclear war. Strong language and explicit descriptions of sex. 1985. From the book jacket. It is a rare event when a novel sweeps into science fiction like a wondrous force of imagination, of ideas, of excitement. A novel that helps redefine the field by marking new ground in the frontier of science fictional concepts. Such an event is Eon, a grand adventure set in the near future, written by Hugo and Nebula award-winning author Greg Baer. The stone, a large hollow asteroid, suddenly appears in orbit around the Earth. 2 years after its initial appearance, researchers from Earth have explored most of the stone and have learned a great deal about the secrets held in 6 of its 7 large chambers. Theoretical mathematician Patricia Vasquez arrives on the stone during a time of political turmoil on Earth. Summoned into space by high authority for reasons she can only guess at, she's immediately shown all the public wonders of the asteroid artifact by the research project's science coordinator, Gary Lanier. At first, Patricia wonders at his attitude. As he escorts her from one remarkable discovery to the next, he comments only enough to ensure that she knows what she is seeing, allowing her to draw conclusions without his editorial comments. Finally, he shows her the vast libraries of the stone. Armed with her intellectual curiosity and with tantalizing clues, she immerses herself in the fabulous high-tech treasure of knowledge from what appears to be the future. After several weeks, she begins to grasp the true enormity of her task and the deadly peril of her situation. For the stone was paradoxically made by people from Earth, in the past, on an Earth in another universe. And somehow the stone is the key to the destiny of our Earth, as well as that of the Earth whence its builders came. For Patricia, the twinned destinies of the Earths are more than a mere theoretical problem. The other Earth has already been destroyed. The stone's libraries have historical records of the devastation, and events on our Earth are swiftly moving in deadly tandem to their recorded parallels on the other world. If the stone's records are accurate, our Earth's destruction looms a few scant weeks away. Patricia is torn between joy, the intricate and elegant mathematics of alternate universes, and the horror she feels when she realizes that every passing day may bring Earth's destruction a day closer. In short, she's been felled by the terrible reality that is shared only by those who have probed the stone's secrets. Her problems quickly become undone, however, when Russian soldiers invade the stone. She is kidnapped by boojums, ghosts, from beyond the 7th chamber, and hurtled 1,000,000 kilometers into the future. Then begins the larger adventure, for Patricia and for all of mankind. For some it will mean the end of life, for others the beginning of a new life, both strange and rich beyond the mere imaginings of our dreams. And for Patricia, it will be the start of her search for a way home. About the author. The author of nearly 10 books, including the recent novels Blood Music and The Infinity Concerto, Greg Baer is the winner of both the Hugo and the Nebula Awards for his short science fiction. He has degrees in both physics and mathematics. He and his wife Astrid Anderson live in Santee, California. Other books by Greg Baer. Hegira, Beyond Heaven's River, Cyclone, Strength of Stones. Dedication for Powell and Karen, with much appreciation and love. Prologue. 4 beginnings. 1. Christmas Eve, 2000, New York City. It's going into a wide elliptical Earth orbit, Judith Hoffman said. Perigee about 10,000 kilometers, apogee about 500,000. It'll make a loop around the moon every third orbit. She pulled back from the video screen to let Gary Lanier have a look. For the time being, the stone still resembled a baked potato, with little meaningful detail. Outside the door to the office, the noise of the party was a distant reminder of ignored social obligations. That must be an incredible fluke.
It's not a fluke, Hoffman said.
She had brought him into her office just a few minutes before. Lanier sat on the edge of her desk. Tall, with close-cut, dense black hair, he resembled a pale-skinned Amerindian, though he had no Indian blood. Hoffman found his eyes particularly reassuring, gently scrutinizing, the eyes of a man used to seeing across great distances. She did not put her trust in people on the basis of looks, however. She had taken to Lanier because he had taught her something. Some had called him bloodless, but Hoffman knew better. The man was simply competent, calm, and observant. He had a kind of blindness to people's foibles that made him peculiarly effective as a manager. He seldom seemed to recognize petty insults, bitchiness, or backbiting. He saw people only in terms of their effectiveness, or lack of it, at least as far as his public reactions showed. He cut through their surface dross and found what true coin might lie beneath. She had learned some interesting things about several people by observing their reactions to Lanier, and she had adapted her own style, picking up on his finesse. Lanier had never been in Hoffman's at-home work area before, and now, in the video's cool light, he inspected the shelves of memory blocks, the broad, empty desk with its basic secretary's chair, the compact word processor beneath the video. Like most of the partygoers, Lanier was a little in awe of Hoffman. On the Hill, she was called the advisor. She had acted in official and unofficial capacities as a science expert for three presidents. Her video programs reviving interest in and re-exploring science had been popular in the late 1990s, in a world just recovering from the shock of the little death. She had served on the board of directors of both the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and now ISCCOM, the International Space Cooperation Committee. Her taste in clothes was impeccable, though she could not disguise her solid build. There was a conscious limit to her style. Her fingernails were short and unpainted, well manicured but not elegant, and she wore little makeup. She allowed her brunette hair to find its own shape with a minimum of interference. It tended to make a nimbus of fine curls around her head. Lanier had entered her circle while working as a public relations manager for AT&T Orbicom Services. Before being employed by Orbicom, he had spent 6 years in the Navy, first as a fighter pilot, then flying high-altitude tankers. He had flown the famous Charlie Baker Delta route over Florida, Cuba, and Bermuda during the Little Death, refueling the planes of the Atlantic Watch, whose vigilance had played such a crucial role in limiting the war. After the armistice, he had received an okay from the Navy to take his expertise in aerospace engineering over to Orbicom, which was tuning up its worldwide civilian mononet. There had been a few calls at first to Orbicom headquarters in Menlo Park, California, then requests for help on position papers, then an abrupt and unexpected transfer to the Orbicom building in Washington, which he later learned had been engineered by Hoffman. There was no question of romance. How often had he quelled that rumor? But their ability to work together was remarkable in a Washington atmosphere of perpetual partisan bickering and funding squabbles. "You must be on the Drake hookup," Lanier said.
"I am, but this is a deep space tracking picture. The Drake is still locked on the Perseus Gemstar."
"They won't turn it on the stone?" She shook her head, grinning wolfishly.
"Feisty old bastards are on a tight schedule. Won't turn it around even for a look at the biggest event of the 21st century.
Lanier raised an eyebrow. The stone, as far as he knew, was just an asteroid. The oblong chunk wasn't going to hit the Earth, but if it was going to orbit, it would be in perfect position for scientific probes. That was interesting, but hardly worthy of so much enthusiasm. 21 isn't until next month, he reminded her.
And that's when we'll be getting busy.
She turned toward him and folded her arms.
Gary, we've been working together for some time now. I trust you.
He felt a tightening at the base of his spine. She had seemed tense all evening. He had dismissed the fidgeting as none of his business.
Now she was making it his business. "What do you know about the stone?" she asked. He thought a moment before answering. "DST located it 8 months ago. It's about 300 kilometers long, 100 kilometers across at midsection. Medium albedo, probably a silicate body with a nickel-iron core. It had a kind of halo around it when first spotted, but that's dissipated. That made a few scientists speculate it was an exceptionally large old comet nucleus. Some conflicting reports on low density revived the old Tsiolkovsky Mars-Moon speculation." "Where did you hear the density reports?"
"I don't remember."
"That reassures me a little bit. If you haven't heard much more than that, probably no one else has either. DST had a leak, but we've plugged it now."
"Why the secrecy?"
"DST has been ordered to mask all data given to the community."
By which she meant the scientific community.
"Why in hell should they do that? Government's relation with the community has been awful the last few years. This certainly won't help."
"Yes, but I concur this time."
Another chill. Hoffman was very dedicated to the community.
"If there's a blanket over everything, how do you know?" Lanier asked.
"Connections through ISCCOM. I've been put on oversight by the president."
"Jesus.
So while our friends are partying out there, I need to know if I can rely on you."
"Judith, I'm just a second-rank PR type."
"Bullshit. Orbicom thinks you're the best personnel coordinator they have. I had to wrestle Parker for 3 months to get you transferred to Washington. You were lined up for a promotion, know that?"
Truthfully, he had hoped to avoid another promotion. He felt he was getting away from the real work, higher and higher up the Tower of Power. "And you got me transferred instead?"
"Pulled enough strings to look like the puppet master I'm supposed to be. I may need you. You know I don't pick candidates unless I'm sure they'll yank my ass out of the fire later."
He nodded. To be part of Hoffman's circle was to be groomed for importance. Until now he had tried to overlook that as a truism.
"Do you remember the supernova sighted about the same time as the stone?"
Lanier nodded. It had made a brief splash in the journals, and he had been too busy to find that low-profile coverage odd.
"It wasn't a supernova. Just as bright, but it didn't match any of the requirements. In the first place, it was first recorded by DST as an infrared object just outside the solar system. Within 2 days, the flare became visible, and DST detected radiation of frequencies associated with every atomic transition. The flare temperature started at 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin and peaked at just over 1,000,000,000 degrees. By that time, nuclear explosion detectors on satellites, the new GPS Super Vela, were picking up thermally excited gamma rays from nuclear transitions. It was clearly visible in the night sky, so DST had to make up a cover story, and that was the discovery of a supernova by space defense installations. But they didn't know what they had."
"And?"
"The display went out, everything got quiet, and then a visual sighting was made in the same portion of the sky. It was the stone. By that time, everybody knew they weren't dealing with a simple asteroid."
The video pictures flickered, and a chime sounded.
"Well, here it is. Joint Space Command has taken over the Drake and rotated it."
The Drake was the most powerful orbiting optical telescope. There were bigger instruments being built on Lunar Far Side, but none yet in operation matched the Drake. It had no Defense Department connection. Joint Space Command legally had no jurisdiction, except in time of national security crisis. The stone appeared on the screen greatly enlarged and cradled in numbers and science data graphs. Much more detail was evident. A big crater at one end of the oblong, smaller craters all over, a peculiar band running latitudinally.
"It still looks like an asteroid," Lanier said, his voice lacking conviction.
"Indeed," Hoffman said. "We know the type. A very large mesosiderite. We know the composition. But it's missing about 40% of its mass. DST confirmed that this morning. That chunk's profile through the center resembles a geode."
"Geodes don't occur in space, Gary. The president has already accepted my recommendation that we organize an investigation. That was before the elections, but I think we can push it with the new administration, cracker barrel mentality or not.
Just as a precaution, we're scheduling 6 orbital transfer vehicle flights before the end of February, and I'm laying my bets down early. I think we're going to need a science team, and I'd like you to coordinate for me. I'm sure we can arrange something with Orbicom.
But why the secrecy?
Why, Gary, I'm surprised. She smiled warmly at him. When the aliens arrive, the government always goes in for secrecy.
2. August 2001, Podlipke Airfield near Moscow. Major Mirsky, you are not concentrating on your task. My suit is leaking, Colonel Mayakovsky. That is irrelevant. You can stay in the tank for another 15 or 20 minutes. Yes, Colonel. Now pay attention. You must complete this maneuver. Mirsky blinked sweat from his eyes and strained to see the American-style docking hatch clearly. The water was already up to his knees in the pressure suit. He could feel the stream entering through the seam at his hip. There was no way of telling how copious the flow was. He hoped Mayakovsky knew. He had been instructed to wedge the bent metal bar into the 2 sensor ports. To get the necessary traction to jam it home, he hooked his ankle and right wrist to the circular lip of the hatch, using the L-shaped attachments on his boots and glove. Then with his left hand, how they had tried to discourage him in school in Kiev, now gone, all of his teachers and their 19th century ideas, how they had tried to get him to use his right hand exclusively, until finally, in his late teens, an edict had come down officially pardoning gauche children. Yiske swam the bar. He unhooked his wrist and ankles and pushed back. The water was up to his waist. Colonel, the hatch will pause before opening. 3 minutes. Mirsky bit his lip. He twisted his neck around within the helmet to see how his teammates were doing. The 5 lined-up hatches were manned. 2 men and Yefremova. Where was Orlov? There, pushing his helmet back, Mirsky saw Orlov being hauled to the surface of the tank, 3 wet-suited scuba-equipped divers assisting him to shadowy obscurity. The surface, the lovely surface, sweet air and no water streaming in. He couldn't feel it now. The level was above his hip. The hatch began to move. He could hear the mechanism whining. Then it stopped, only 1/3 open. It's stuck, he said, stunned. He was reasonably sure the exercise was supposed to be over as soon as he could enter the hatch, and the hatch was supposed to be foolproof. It was supposed to open when properly jimmied. American word, American technology. Reliable, no? Loosen it. Your bar is obviously not positioned properly. It is, Mirsky insisted. Major? Yes, yes. He jammed the heel of his heavily gloved hand against the bar again. He hadn't hooked his ankles and right wrist. He floated away from the hatch and had to waste precious seconds reeling in his line and dragging himself back. Hook, pound, unhook. No result. Water up to his chest. Cold. Slopping past his neck seal into his helmet when his angle shifted. He swallowed some accidentally and choked. There, Colonel will think I'm drowning and show mercy. Jiggle it, the Colonel suggested. His gloves were almost too thick to reach into the groove where the bar now resided, held in place by the partly open hatch. He pressed, his sleeves filled with cold and his fingers numbing. He pressed again. His suit was no longer neutrally buoyant. He was starting to sink. The bottom of the tank was 30 meters below, and all 3 of the divers had accompanied Orlov. There was nobody between him and drowning if he could not make it to the simulated Soviet hatch on his own power. And if he did not leave now... But he didn't dare. He had wanted the stars since adolescence, and panicking now would put them out of his reach forever. He screamed in his helmet and slammed his glove tip into the groove, causing a sharp, freezing jolt of pain to go up his arm as his fingers crammed into the inner fabric and casing. The hatch began to move again. Just jammed, the colonel said. I'm drowning, goddammit, Mirsky shouted. He hooked his wrists under the lip of the ring and sputtered water from his mouth. The suit's air entered and exited just above the neck ring of his helmet, and he could already hear the suck and gurgle. Floodlights came on around the tank. The hatches were suspended in watery noon brightness. He felt hands under his arms and around his legs,
and saw the three other cosmonaut trainees vaguely from the corners of his foggy faceplate. They kicked away from the hatch complex and hauled him higher, higher, to his grandmother's archaic and welcome heaven. They sat at their special table away from the 200 other recruits and were served fine thick sausages with their kasha. The beer was cold and plentiful, if sour and watery, and there were oranges and carrots and cabbage cores. And for dessert, a big steel bowl of fresh-made rich vanilla ice cream, unavailable for months while they trained, was set before them by a smiling mess officer. When dinner was over, Efremova and Nirsky strolled across the grounds of the Cosmonaut Instructional Center with its hideous black steel water tank half buried in the ground. Efremova came from Moscow and had a fine eastern slant to her eyes. Nirsky from Kiev could as easily have been German as Russian. Still, coming from Kiev had its advantages. A man without a city. This was something Russians could sympathize with, feel sad about. They spoke very little. They thought they were in love, but that was irrelevant. Efremova was one of 14 women in the Space Shock Troops program. Her femaleness kept her even busier than the men. She had trained as a pilot in the Air Defense Forces before that, flying Tu-22M training bombers and old Sukhoi fighters. He had come into the military after graduating from an aerospace engineering school. His deferment had been most fortunate. Instead of being inducted into the Army at 18, he had qualified for a new reindustrialization scholarship. In the engineering school, he had gained excellent marks in political science and leadership, and they had earmarked him immediately for the difficult position of Zumpolit in a fighter squadron in East Germany, but then had transferred him to Space Defense Forces, which had only been in existence for 4 years. He had never heard of it before, the transfer, but such a stroke of luck. He had always wanted to be a cosmonaut. Efremova's father was a high-ranking Moscow bureaucrat. He had put her into what he thought would be a safe military training program, rather than let her run wild with Moscow's infamous young hooligans. She had turned out to be very capable and very bright. Her future was promising, though not what her father had expected. Their backgrounds were worlds apart, and chances were they would never even have a chance to date, much less conduct an affair or get married. "Look," Efremova said, "you can see it clearly tonight." "Yes?" He knew immediately what she meant. "There." She leaned her head close to his and pointed above the summer's long blue twilight to a tiny spot of light just beside the full moon. "They will get there before we do," Efremova said sadly. "They always do now." "So pessimistic," Nirsky said. "I wonder what they call it," she said. "What they will name it when they land." "Not the potato, surely," Nirsky chuckled. "No," Efremova agreed. "Someday," Nirsky said, squinting to make the spot out more clearly.
"Someday what?"
"Perhaps the time will come when we will take it away from them."
"Dreamer," Efremova said.
The next week, a two-man vacuum chamber imploded on the outskirts of the airfield. Efremova was testing a new suit design in one half of the chamber. She was killed instantly. There was great concern about the political repercussions of the accident, but as it turned out, her father was not unreasonable. Better to have a martyr in the family than a hooligan. Mirsky took an unscheduled day's absence with a bottle of brandy smuggled in from Yugoslavia. He spent the day alone in a Moscow park and did not even open the bottle. After a year, he finished his training and was promoted. He left Podlipke and spent 2 weeks in Starry Town, where he visited Yuri Gagarin's room, now a kind of shrine for spacefarers. From there, he was flown to a secret facility in Mongolia, and then to the moon. And always he kept his eye on the potato. Someday he knew he would go there, and not as an ISK-COM exchange Russian. A nation could only stand so much. 3. Christmas Eve, 2004, Santa Barbara, California. Patricia Luisa Vasquez opened the car door to release her seat harness. She was anxious to get into the house and start the festivities. The psychological testing at Vandenberg the past few days had been exhausting.
Wait, Paul Lopez said. He put a hand on her arm, then stared at the dashboard. Vivaldi's Four Seasons played on the car stereo. Your folks aren't going to want to know. Don't worry about it, she said, pulling back a strand of very dark brown, almost black hair. The lower half of her round face was illuminated by an orange streetlight, light olive skin, pink in the sodium glow. She regarded Paul solicitously, tying her hair into two braids parted in the middle. Her square, intense eyes reminded him of a cat's gaze just before pouncing. They'll love it, she said, laying hand on his shoulder and stroking his cheek. You're the first non-Anglo boyfriend I've ever introduced them to. I mean about us rooming together. What they don't know won't hurt them. I feel a little awkward. You keep talking about your parents being old-fashioned. I just wanted you to meet them and to show you my home. I want that, too. Listen, with the news I have tonight, nobody's going to worry about my maidenhood. If Mom asks how serious we are, I'll let you answer. Paul grimaced. Great. Patricia pulled his hand toward her and made a rude sound against the palm with her lips, then opened the door. Wait.
What now?
I'm not... I mean, you know that I love you.
Paul,
it's just, come on inside and meet my family. You'll calm down, and don't worry. They locked the car door and opened the trunk, pulling groceries out of the back. She huffed up the front walk with a box, her breath clouding in the cold night air. She wiped her feet on the front step mat, swung the screen door wide, caught it with her elbow, and shouted, Mama, it's me, and I brought Paul, too. Rita Vasquez took the box from her daughter's arms and laid it down on the kitchen table. At 45, Rita was only slightly plump, but the clothes she wore invariably conflicted with even Patricia's rudimentary sense of fashion. What is this, a care package? Rita asked. She held her arms out and folded Patricia in them. Mama, where did you get that polyester suit? I haven't seen one of those in years. I found it in the garage, packed away. Your father bought it for me before you were born. So where's Paul? He's carrying in two more boxes. She removed her coat and savored the smells of tamales steaming in corn husks, baking ham and sweet potato pie. Smells like home, she said, and Rita beamed. In the living room, the aluminum tree was still bare. Decorating the tree on Christmas Eve was a family tradition, and a gas log burned brightly in the fireplace. She reacquainted herself with the old plaster bas-reliefs of grapes and vines and leaves beneath the cornice and the heavy wooden beams across the ceiling. She smiled. She had been born in this house. Wherever she went, however far, this would be home to her. Where are Julia and Robert? Robert's been stationed in Omaha, Rita answered from the kitchen. They can't make it this year. Be out in March, maybe. Oh, Patricia said, disappointed. She returned to the kitchen. Where's Papa?
Watching TV.
Paul came in the kitchen door, heavily loaded. Patricia took one of the boxes from him and laid it on the floor next to the refrigerator for unloading. We were expecting an army, so we brought lots of stuff, she said. Rita pushed through layers of food and shook her head. It'll get eaten. We're having Mr. and Mrs. Ortiz from next door, and Cousin Enrique and his new wife. So this is Paul.
Yup.
Rita hugged him, her arms barely meeting around his back. She took hold of both his hands and stood away, surveying. He smiled. Tall, thin Paul, with his brown hair and light skin, looking more Anglo than the others. Still, Rita smiled as they talked. Paul could hold his own. She walked down the hall to the den where her father would be sitting in front of the television. They had never been well off, and the TV was a 25-year-old model that made a rainbow ghost whenever it received 3D transmissions. Papa, Patricia said quietly, sneaking up behind him in the half-dark.
Patty.
Ramon Vasquez looked around the rear cushion of his chair, a big grin lifting his pepper-gray mustache. He had been partly paralyzed by a stroke 3 years before, and even with surgery hadn't fully recovered. Patricia sat on the divan beside him.
I've brought Paul home with me, she said. I'm sorry Julia can't be here this time.
Me too, but that's Air Force. Ramon had been in the Air Force for 20 years before retiring in 1996.
Except for Patricia, the family was enmeshed in the Air Force. Julia had met Robert at a party on March Air Force Base 6 years ago.
"I've got something to tell everybody, Papa."
"Oh? What's that?"
Had his speech improved since they last talked face to face? It seemed so. She hoped so.
Rita called out from the kitchen.
"Daughter, come help me and Paul put away this stuff."
"What are you watching?" Patricia asked, reluctant to leave.
"News." A commentator and his scarcely less formidable ghost was leading into a story about the stone. Patricia lingered despite her mother's second call. As more and more personnel are sent to the stone, citizen and scientific groups are asking for an open forum. Today, in the fourth year of a joint NATO-Eurospace investigation, the cloak wrapped around the stone is as impenetrable as ever, and
so it was no news after all.
Russian participants are particularly unhappy with the requirements for secrecy. Meanwhile, protesters from the Planetary Society, the L5 Society, the Friends for Interstellar Relations, and other groups have gathered around the White House and around the so-called Blue Cube in Sunnyvale, California, protesting military involvement and alleging a cover-up of major discoveries within the stone. An earnest, clean-cut, and conservatively dressed young man appeared on the screen. He stood in front of the White House and spoke with exaggerated gestures.
"We know it's an alien artifact, and we know there are seven chambers inside, huge chambers. We didn't put them there. There are cities in every chamber, deserted cities, all but the seventh. And there's something incredible there, something unimaginable."
"What do you think it is?" the interviewer asked. The protester flung his hands up.
"We think they should tell everybody. Whatever's there, we as taxpayers have the right to know."
The commentator added that NASA and Joint Space Command spokespersons had no comment. Patricia sighed and placed her hands on Ramon's shoulders, automatically rubbing his muscles. Paul watched her closely at dinner, waiting for her to find the right opportunity, but she didn't. She felt uncomfortable with the friends and neighbors present. This was something only her immediate family should know, and she couldn't tell even them as much as she wanted. Rita and Ramon seemed to accept Paul. That was a plus. Eventually, they would have to know about the living arrangements, if they hadn't figured it out already, that Patricia and Paul were more than just dating acquaintances, that they were living together in that haphazard way reserved for co-ed dormitories. So many secrets and discretions. Perhaps they wouldn't be as shocked as she expected, wanted them to be. It was a little disturbing to think that her parents might regard her as a grown-up sexual being. She was not nearly as open about it as most of her friends and acquaintances. Eventually, she and Paul would be married, she was sure. But they were both young, and Paul was not going to ask until he felt he could support them both, or until she convinced him that she could. And even with her doctorate, that wasn't likely for several more years. Not counting, of course, the pay she would receive from Judith Hoffman's group. That money would go into a separate security account until her return. When the dishes were cleared and everyone had gathered around the tree, family and friends helping to decorate, she signaled her mother that they had to talk in the kitchen.
"And bring Papa."
Rita helped Ramon into the kitchen on his aluminum crutches, and they sat around the battered wooden table that had been in the family for at least 60 years.
"I have something to tell you," Patricia began.
"Oh, Madre de Dios,"
Rita said, clasping her hands and smiling rapturously.
"No, Mama, it's not about Paul and me," she said.
Her mother's face stiffened, then relaxed.
"So what, then?"
"Last week I received a phone call at school," Patricia said. "I can't tell you all about it, but I'm going to be gone for a couple of months, even longer. Paul knows about it, but I can't tell him any more than I've just told you." Paul entered the kitchen through the swinging doors.
"Who was it called you?" Ramon asked.
"Judith Hoffman."
"Who's that?" Rita said.
"The woman on television?" Ramon asked.
Patricia nodded. "She's an advisor to the president. They want me to work on something with them, and that's as much as I can tell you."
"Why should they want you?" Rita asked.
"I think they want her to build a time machine," Paul said. Whenever he had said that before, Patricia had become angry, but now she shrugged it off. She couldn't expect Paul to understand her work. Very few people did, certainly not her parents and friends.
Paul has some other crazy theories, too, she said, but my lips are sealed.
Like a clam, Paul said. She's been hard to live with the past few days.
If you wouldn't keep trying to get me to talk...
She sighed dramatically. She was doing a lot of that lately, and looked at the cream-colored ceiling, then turned to her father.
It's going to be very interesting. Nobody will be able to reach me directly. You can send mail for me to this address.
She drew the phone pad across the table and wrote down an APO address.
Is this important to you? Rita asked.
Of course it is, Ramon answered. But Patricia didn't know. It sounded crazy even now. After the guests had left, she took Paul on a nighttime tour of the neighborhood. For a half hour, they walked in silence, passing from one streetlight glow to the next.
I'm coming back, you know, she said finally.
I know.
I had to show you my home, because it's very important to me. Rita, Ramon, the house.
Yes, Paul said.
I think I'd be lost without it. I spend so much time in my head, and what I do there is so different, so bizarre to most people. If I didn't have a center, a place to return to, I'd get lost.
I understand, Paul said. It's a very nice home. I like your folks. She stopped him, and they faced each other, holding hands at arm's length.
I'm glad, she said.
I want to make a home with you, too, he said. Another center, for both of us to come back to. Her expression was so intense, she seemed about to leap on him. Cat's eyes, Paul said, grinning. They circled back and kissed on the front porch before going in to join her parents for coffee and cinnamon cocoa. One last pit stop, she said as they prepared to drive back to Caltech. She walked down the hall to the bathroom, past the graduation pictures and the framed contents page of the issue of American Journal of Physics her first paper had appeared in. She stopped in front of the cover and stared intently at it. Suddenly her heart seemed to miss a beat, leaving a peculiar hollow in her chest. A brief, almost pleasant sensation of falling, fading, then returning to normal. She'd felt it before. It was nothing serious, just a cold wind down the middle of her chest every time she truly accepted the idea of where she was going. 4. 1174, Journey Year 5 Nadir, Axis City. The presiding minister of the Axis City, Ilyan Tor Engel, stood on the broad observation blister, staring out across the way, through the city's blue glow, at lanes bright with the continuous flow of traffic between the gates. Behind him stood two assigned ghosts and a corporeal representative of the Hexamon Nexus. "Do you know Olmi well, Ser Franco?" the presiding minister picted, using graphic speak.
"No, Ser Engel, I do not," the corporeal representative replied, "though by reputation he is famous in the Nexus. Three incarnations, one more than law allows because of his extraordinary service. Olmi is one of our oldest citizens, still corporeal," the minister said. "An enigmatic personality. He would have long since forfeited his majority rights and retired to city memory if it wasn't for his usefulness to the Nexus." The PM instructed a sprayer to release his special variety of Talcet. The mist filled a cubic area surrounded by faintly glowing purple traction fields. Engel entered the field and took a deep breath. The ghosts hadn't moved, their images fixed until called upon, visible only to indicate their city memory personalities were tuned into the chamber, listening and watching. "He is of Naderite background himself, I believe," the corporeal assistant said. "Yes, he is," the minister said, nodding. "But he serves the Hexamon regardless of who is in power, and I have no doubt where his loyalties lie. A most unusual man. Tough, in the old sense of the word. A man who has lived through great changes, great pain. I've had him recalled from 1.3X9. He's been supervising our preparations for the Jart offensive. But he can be of more use to us here. He is the one to send now. Axis Nadir can't disagree with him or accuse us of partisan assignment. His reports to them are always detailed and accurate. Inform the president that we are accepting the task and sending Olmi." "Yes, Ser Engel. I believe the ghosts have their questions answered now.
We listen, said one ghost. The other did not move.
Fine. Now I will meet with Seromi. The ghosts faded, and Corporate Franco left, fingering his neck torque, depict a flag of official business over his left shoulder. The PM turned off the traction fields, and the chamber became smoky with more talcet. The smell was disconcerting, sharp like old wine, as Olmi entered. He approached the minister quietly, not wishing to interrupt his reverie. Forward, Ser Olmi, the minister said. He turned as Olmi walked up the steps to the blister platform. You're looking fit today.
And you, sir?
My wife made me a wonderful forgetting last term. Removed much unpleasantness from my 20th year. That was not a good year, and the loss was a relief.
Excellent, sir.
When will you marry, Olmi?
When I find the woman who can purge my 21st year, first incarnation.
The minister laughed heartily. I hear you keep a fine advocate company in Axis Nader. What's her name?
Suli Ram Kikura.
Yes, of course. She's been active smoothing things between the Nexus and the Korzhanovsky hotheads, has she not?
Yes. We seldom discuss it.
The minister sucked in his breath, looked concerned, and stared down at the platform. Well, just so then. I have a difficult mission for you.
My joy to serve the Hexamon.
Perhaps not this time. No mere investigation of illegal gate commerce. Every few decades we send someone back to the Thistledown to check stability. But we are doubly motivated this time. The Thistledown has been reoccupied.
Someone crossing the forbidden territories?
No. More puzzling. Nothing has disturbed our sentries at the first barrier. Apparently, the occupants have entered the Thistledown from outside. Perhaps more startling, they are human. Not in great force, but they're organized. There's no use speculating where they come from. The information is too equivocated. You'll have authority, of course, and the necessary transportation. Sir Algoli will inform you about the other requirements. Understand?
Olmi nodded.
Sir? Good. The minister leaned over the railing and peered at the surface 20 kilometers below. A maelstrom of lights swirled around several of the lanes. There appears to be a jam up at that gate. Ah, it's the season for worries. The month of the good man. He turned to Olmi. Good luck, or as the Eld put it, star, fate, and Numa be kind.
Thank you, sir.
He stepped back from the platform and left the chamber, taking the lift up the long, slender pylon to the central city, where he arranged his affairs for a protracted absence. The assignment was a privilege. Return to the Thistledown was forbidden for any purpose not essential to the Nexus. Olmi hadn't been there for well over 400 years. On the other hand, of course, it could be a very dangerous mission, especially with information so equivocated. He could help ensure his mission's success by bringing along a friend.
If there were humans in the Thistledown, and they weren't city renegades, the most likely explanation, then where did they come from?
Far too narrow and equivocated for his ease. Chapter 1, April 2005. On the first leg of the trip, in the passenger cabin of the long bed shuttle, Patricia Vasquez had watched the Earth's cloud-smeared limb on a video monitor. Before her own transfer, cameras mounted in the shuttle bay had shown her the long Waldos maneuvering the huge cargo out of the bay into the waiting arms of the OTV, orbital transfer vehicle, as if two spiders were trading a cocoon-wrapped fly. The operation had taken an hour, and with its slow fascination had distracted her from thoughts about her present circumstances. When her own turn came and she donned the passenger bubble to be guided across the 10 meters to the OTV's lock, she worked hard to appear calm. The bubble was made of transparent plastic, so she did not suffer from claustrophobia, almost the opposite, in fact. She could feel the immensity of the blackness beyond the spacecraft, though she could not make out stars. They were outdone by the glow of the Earth and the close, brightly lighted surfaces of the OTV, a train of clustered tanks, balls, and prisms,
wrapped in aluminum beams. The three-man, two-woman crew of the OTV greeted her warmly in the narrow tunnel as she hatched, then guided her to a seat just behind theirs. From that vantage, she had a clear, direct view, and now she could see the steady pinpoints of stars. So confronted, with none of the comfortable separation of a video monitor frame, space seemed to extend into a mating of infinite star-cluttered halls. She felt as if she could walk down any one of the halls and become lost in altered perspective. She still wore the black jumpsuit she had been handed in Florida just 6 hours before. She felt dirty. Her hair, even though tied up in a bun, let loose irritating wisps. She could smell her own nervousness. The crew floated around her, making last-minute checks, punching readings into slates and processors. Patricia examined their colored suits. The women in red and blue, the men in green and black and gray, and idly wondered how they were ranked and who commanded. Everything seemed casually efficient, with no deference in voice or manner, as if they were civilians, but they were not. The OTV was a registered unarmed military vehicle, subject to the restrictions imposed after the Little Death. It was one of dozens of new vehicles that had been constructed in Earth orbit since the appearance of the stone, and it differed substantially from the vehicles that had serviced the Joint Space Force's orbital defense platforms. It was larger and capable of traveling much greater distances. By treaty, it could not carry cargoes to the ODPs. "We're leaving in 3 minutes," said the shuttle's co-pilot, a blonde woman whose name Patricia had already forgotten. She touched Patricia on the shoulder and smiled. "Everything will be hectic for a half hour or so. If you need a drink or have to use the lavatory, now's the time." Patricia shook her head and returned the smile. "I'm fine." "Good. Virgin?" Patricia stared. "First flight, she means," the other woman clarified. Patricia remembered her name, Rita, just like her mother. "Of course," Patricia said. "Would I be sitting here acting like a cow in a slaughterhouse otherwise?" The blonde laughed. The pilot, James or Jack, with beautiful green eyes, looked over his shoulder at her, his head framed by the belt and sword of Orion. "Relax, Patricia," he said. So calm. She was almost intimidated by their professional assurance. They were spacefarers, originally assigned to the near-Earth orbit platforms, and now working the distances between Earth, Moon, and Stone. She was just a young woman, fresh out of graduate school, and she had never in her life even left the state of California until traveling to Florida for the shuttle flight from Kennedy Space Center. She wondered what her father and mother were doing now, sitting at home in Santa Barbara. Where did they imagine their daughter to be? She had said goodbye just a week ago. Her stomach still churned at the memory of her last few moments with Paul. His letters would get to her, that was guaranteed, forwarded through the APO address. But what could she tell him in her return messages? Very likely nothing. And her time in space had been estimated at 2 months minimum. She listened to the rumble and purr of the OTV machinery. She heard fuel pumps, mystery noises, gurgles like large water bubbles popping behind the passenger cabin, then the sharp tings of the attitude motors driving the craft away from the shuttle. They began rotating, their axis somewhere near the middle of the cocoon cargo, clamped where a spare hexagonal fuel tank would have otherwise been. The OTV lurched forward with the impulse of its first engine burn. The blonde, still not in her seat, landed on her feet against the rear bulkhead, flexed her knees with the impact, and finished her sequence on the processor. Then everyone buckled in. The second burn took place 15 minutes later. Patricia closed her eyes, nestled into the couch, and resumed work on a problem she had put aside more than 2 weeks before. She had never required paper during the initial stages of her work. Now the fracture symbols paraded before her, separated by her own brand of sign notation, invented when she was 10 years old. There was no music. She usually listened to Vivaldi or Mozart while working, but nevertheless, she became immersed in a sea of abstraction. Her hand went to the pack of music coins and the slate stereo attachment in her small effects bag. A few minutes later, she opened her eyes. Everyone was in their seats, staring intently at instrument panels. She tried to nap. Briefly, before dozing off, she ran through her big question again.
Why had she, in particular, been chosen from a list of mathematicians that must have been meters long? That she had won a Fields Award didn't seem reason enough. There were other mathematicians of far greater experience and stature. Hoffman hadn't really offered an explanation. All she had said was, "You're going to the stone. All that you'll need to know is up there, and it's classified, so I'm not allowed to give you documents while you're here on Earth. You'll have a hell of a lot of studying to do, and I'm sure it will be glorious fun for a mind like yours." As far as Patricia knew, her expertise had no practical use whatsoever, and she preferred it that way. She didn't doubt her talents, but the very fact that they were calling on her, that they might need to know about, as she had expressed it in her doctoral dissertation, non-gravity-bent geodesics of n-spatial reference frames, an approach to superspace visualization and probability clustering, made her even more apprehensive. 6 years ago, a Stanford math professor had told her that the only beings who would ever fully appreciate her work would be gods or extraterrestrials. In the dark, sleepily drifting away from the OTV noises and the sensation of her stomach pressing always upward, she thought of the stone. The governments involved did not discourage speculation, but provided no fuel to feed the fires. The Russians, allowed on the stone only the last year, hinted darkly at what their researchers had seen. Amateur astronomers, and a few civilian professionals who hadn't been visited by government agents, had pointed out the three regular latitudinal bands and the odd dimples at each pole, as if it had been turned on a lathe. The upshot was, everyone knew it was big news, perhaps the biggest news of all time. And so it wasn't incredible that Paul, putting a few odd facts together, had told her he thought she was going to the stone. "You're just too far out of mind to be going anywhere else," he had said. Gods and extraterrestrials. Still, she managed to nap. When she awoke, she saw the stone briefly as the OTV swung around for its docking maneuver. It looked much like the pictures she had seen many times before, published in newspapers and magazines, bean-shaped, about a third as wide in the middle as it was long, heavily cratered between the smoothly artificial excavated bands. 91 kilometers in diameter at its widest, 292 kilometers long. Rock and nickel and iron, and not nearly as simple as that. "Approaching South Polar Axis," the blonde said, leaning around in her chair to look back at Vasquez. "A little briefing in case they haven't told you already. Blind leading the blind, honey." She glanced meaningfully at her shipmates. "First, some facts and figures important to mere navigators. Note that the stone is rotating on its long axis. That's nothing surprising. Everyone knows that. But it's rotating once every 7 minutes or so." "Every 6.824 minutes, James or Jack corrected. "That means," the blonde continued, unfazed, "that anything loose on the outer surface will fly away at a pretty good clip, so we can't dock there. We have to go through the pole." "There's stuff inside?" Patricia asked. "Quite a lot of stuff, if they're keeping everything and everyone we've been bringing up in the past few years," James or Jack said. "The stone's albedo matches any of a number of silicious asteroids. Apparently that's what it was at one time. Here's the South Pole now," Rita said. In the middle of the large polar crater was an indentation, judging from the scale of the stone itself, quite tiny, no more than a kilometer deep and 3 or 4 kilometers wide. The stone's rotation was easily discernible. As the OTV matched course with the stone, then began its approach along the axis, the crater enlarged and showed even more detail. With hardly any surprise at all, Patricia realized the floor was marked by shallow hexagons, like a beehive. At the center of the indentation was a circular black spot about 100 meters across. A hole. An entrance. It loomed larger and larger, but lost none of its intense blackness. The OTV slid into the hole. "We have to maintain our position about 5 minutes, until they bring the rotating dock up to speed," James or Jack said.
"We did all this?" Patricia asked, her voice unsteady. "In just 5 years?"
"No, honey," the blonde said. "It was here already. I'm sure you've heard the stone is hollow inside with 7 chambers. We have a fair number of personnel and thousands of tons of equipment in there, doing God knows what and finding things we'd give our eye teeth to see, believe me.
But this is where our knowledge stops, and we've been instructed not to pass along rumor. You won't be needing it.
We've been riding a docking signal for the last 7 minutes, James or Jack said. Voice contact any second. The radio chimed.
OTV 37, a calm tenor male voice said. We have prime dock rotating. Advance at 0.1 meters per second.
Rita flipped a switch and the OTV's floods came on, partially illuminating the inside of a gray cylinder that dwarfed the craft. Four rows of lights appeared ahead of them, wobbling back and forth slightly as the rotating dock adjusted its speed. Here we go. The OTV advanced slowly. Patricia nodded and held her hands tightly in her lap. The bump was hardly discernible as the OTV motors went ting all around and brought them to a stop inside the tunnel. A hatch opened ahead of the ship, and three men in spacesuits floated into view, carrying cables. They used suit thrusters to fly around the OTV and tie it down. You're hooked, OTV 37, the radio voice said a few minutes later. Welcome to the Stone. Thanks, James or Jack said. We have a big load in the hopper and precious cargo up front. Treat them gently.
400 domestic.
Domestic. Best California vintage. Patricia didn't know whether they were talking about a cargo of wine or her. She was too nervous to ask.
Got you clear. Any more mysteries to leak to us, guide? The blonde asked. My people want the hopper cargo released in 5 minutes.
Timing on.
More mysteries. Let's see. Why is a raven like a writing desk?
Bastard.
I'll think on it, James or Jack said.
He switched off the mic and floated up from his couch to help Patricia with her belts. Close-mouthed all of them, he said, guiding her to the lock access corridor. I leave you to their tender mercies. And promise us someday. Pretty please? He patted her shoulder paternally. When all this is settled and we're reminiscing in a bar in Sausalito... He grinned at her, knowing how ridiculous the image was. Tell us what the hell happened up here, step by step. We'll savor it the rest of our lives.
Why do you think they'll tell me? Patricia asked.
Why, don't you know? Rita joined them in the lock. You've been given top billing. You're going to save their collective hide. Patricia climbed into the transfer bubble and they closed the lock behind her. Watching through the lock port, she could see the curious hunger in their faces. The lock hatch swung open, and two men in spacesuits reached in to pull the bubble from the OTV. She was passed along hand to hand through a circular opening in the dock's dark gray surface. Chapter 2 25 kilometers below the axis, the Stone's spin produced a force of 0.6 G. Gary Lanier took daily advantage of that to perform gymnastic feats difficult or impossible for him on Earth. He swung back and forth, blowing out his breath forcefully and grunting, holding his legs straight together and propelling himself high over the parallel bars and the pit of fine white sand. It was easy to twist and reverse his position. Almost as easy was swinging his legs into the air, spinning and doing a reverse that way. The exercise cleared his mind of everything else, for a few minutes at least, and took him back to his days as a college gymnast. The Stone's first chamber, viewed in cross-section, resembled a squat cylinder, 50 kilometers in diameter and 30 across the floor. Since each of the Stone's first six chambers were wider in diameter than in length, it resembled deep valleys, and that's what they were sometimes called. Lanier paused for a second with toes pointed together and stared up at the plasma tube. Rings of light passed through ionized gas only slightly denser than the near vacuum around them, sweeping along the axis from the borehole to the opposite side of the chamber with such speed that the eye interpreted their passage as a continuous hollow shaft or tube. The plasma tube, and extensions in the other chambers, provided all the light for the Stone's interior and had been doing so for some 12 centuries. He dropped to the sandy bed and rubbed his hands on his sweatpants. He worked out for an hour, no more, whenever his schedule allowed, which wasn't often. His muscles were feeling the lack of Earth gravity. At least he was acclimated to the thin air. He ran his hand through his short black hair, face expressionless, pumping his legs slowly to cool them down. Soon, back to the small office in the administration bungalow, back to signing slates, allocating material to the various experiments, looking over the science team shifts and the 5 cramped labs,
scheduling equipment and central processor time, back to the memory blocks and the information coming out of the second and third chambers, and the security squabbles, the Russian team's constant complaints about limited access. He closed his eyes. Those things he could handle. Hoffman had once called him a born administrator, and he didn't deny it. Handling people, especially brilliant, capable people, was his meat and drink. But he would also go back to the tiny figurine in the top drawer of his desk. For him, the figurine symbolized everything peculiar about the stone. It was a lifelike three-dimensional image of a man, encased in a block of crystal. On the base of the block, which stood just under 12 centimeters high, a name had been engraved in neat round letters. Konrad Kuzhinovsky. Kuzhinovsky had been the main engineer on the stone 600 years ago. That was where it began. The library beast, he thought of it, threatening to consume him. The knowledge that had every day taken a bit of his humanity and rubbed it thin, pushing him closer to some sort of personal crisis. There was no way, yet, to deal with what he knew. He and only 10 other people. Soon, an 11th would arrive. He felt sorry for her. The gymnastics pit was half a kilometer from the science team compound, midway between the compound and the barbed wire fence that marked the boundary beyond which no one could go unescorted without a green badge. The valley floor was covered with a soft, sandy layer of soil, not dusty, though dry. A few scrubby patches of grass grew out of the soil, but for the most part the first chamber was arid. The compound itself, one of two in the first chamber, resembled an old Roman encampment, with an earthworks rampart and a shallow, dry moat surrounding the buildings. The rampart was topped with electronic sensors mounted on stakes every 5 meters. All these precautions dated back to the days when it was reasonable to suspect there might still be stoners in the chambers, and that they might present some danger. Out of force of habit, and because the possibility had never been completely ruled out, the precautions were maintained. Lanier crossed the sturdy wooden bridge spanning the moat and climbed a set of steps on the rampart, waving his card at a reader mounted on one of the stakes. He passed the men's and women's barracks and entered the administration bungalow, tapping his finger on Ann Blakely's desk and waving as he walked past. Ann had served him as secretary and general assistant for over a year. She swiveled on her chair and reached for the memo slate. Gary... He shook his head without looking at her and continued on up the stairs. 5 more minutes, he said. On the second floor, he slipped his card into the verification lock on his office door, pressed his thumbs onto the small plate, and entered. The door swung shut automatically behind him. He removed his sweatpants and shirt, substituting the blue science team jumpsuit. The office was neatly organized, but still looked cluttered. A small desk manufactured from OTV tank baffles was flanked by chromium bins filled with rolls of paper. A narrow shelf of real books hung next to racks of memory blocks sealed behind tough, alarm-equipped plastic panels. Maps and diagrams were taped to the walls. A broad window looked out over the compound buildings. North across the valley's barren floor of dirt, sand, and scrub loomed the massive gray presence of the far chamber camp. He sat on a lightweight director's chair and propped his feet on the window frame. His dark eyes, underscored by fatigue lines, focused on a distant point at 1 o'clock high, where the plasma tube butted up against the cap. Through the tube's diffuse glow, it was difficult to make out the 100-meter-wide borehole that pushed through the cap into the second chamber. The borehole opened 5 kilometers above the atmosphere in the chamber. In 2 minutes, his private time would be over. He organized his slates and processors, looking over the day's schedule, preparing himself mentally to be a mover and shaker. There was dirt beneath one fingernail. He removed it with another fingernail. If he could only explain the simple things, the figurine, the barbed wire used to string up the fence, the crate wood used to make the bridge over the moat, it would all fall into place. The stone would explain itself. The only explanations he had now were much too incredible to be sane. His comm line hummed. Yes, Anne. Are you on duty now, Gary? That I am. Transmission down the hole. OTV approach.
Our savior?
I presume.
Hoffman had said this young woman was important, and the advisor's word was one of the few things Lanier felt he could count on. In the 4 years since that night at the party, he had learned a great deal about politics in and out of world capitals and how nations handled crises. He had come to realize how truly extraordinary Hoffman was, capable and with uncanny intuition. But at that party, she had been dead wrong about one thing. The stone's appearance did not signal the arrival of aliens, not in the strict sense of the word. He picked up two slates and a processor. "Anything else?" he asked, standing by Blakely's desk. "In and out," she said, and handed him a cube of messages. There was always a mild, cool breeze flowing down the almost vertical slope of the cap. Sometimes snow fell, piling up in drifts against the nickel iron wall. The elevator entrance, a perfect semicircular arch, had been blasted out of asteroid material, as had all the tunnels, serviceways, and boreholes of the stone, by a fusion torch of extremely high power and efficiency. The sides of the short hall had been polished smooth and etched with acid by the stoners to reveal the beautiful triangular Wittmannstetten patterns, veined with rocky troilite intrusions. The elevator was cylindrical, 10 meters in diameter and 5 meters high, and was used for both personnel and freight. There were hand grips along the perimeter, and tie-downs dimpled the floor. It followed a sloping tunnel to the staging areas surrounding the external borehole. As the elevator climbed, its angular velocity declined, weakening the centrifugal force of the stone's rotation. By the time it reached the vicinity of the borehole, the spin produced only 0.1% G. The trip took 10 minutes. The elevator decelerated smoothly and stopped, its opposite hatch flush with a pressurized tunnel leading to the staging areas. Taking an electric miner's cart, one of the 24 or so brought up from Earth, Lanier rose most of the remaining distance along a magnetic rail. The cart whined to a stop, and Lanier drifted the rest of the way, pulling himself along guide ropes. The first landings in the borehole had been tricky. There had been no power to the rotating docks at that time, and very little illumination. The OTV pilots had proved their skill again and again. The first space-suited explorers had shown great courage in leaving their craft and approaching the borehole walls, which rotated at about 0.75 meters per second. Now that the dock and staging area equipment had been refurbished and brought back into operation, the transfer process was much easier. The three docks were simple, massive, and efficient. Cylinders within the hole rotated to compensate for the stone's spin, each accelerated like the rotor in a giant electric motor. One engineer in a booth below the prime dock controlled all of the docks, opening and closing hatches, coordinating cargo and passenger unloading. The staging areas themselves had been thoroughly customized by the engineering team, outfitted with near-free-fall workshops and machine shops. Here was where bulky cargoes were checked out, repackaged, and either shipped down the elevators to the valley floor or flown along the axis to the next hole and chamber down the line. The director of the engineering team, Lawrence Heineman, was talking to a slight, dark-haired young woman in the prime dock staging area as Lanier pulled himself in. They stood in a bright oval of light, hands on guide ropes, watching as large vacuum doors slid across to reveal the OTV's cocoon cargo resting on joists. The cargo dwarfed them. Heineman, a short, crew-cut, muscular aerospace technician from Florida, smiled broadly and waved his hands, explaining something to the young woman. As Lanier approached, Heineman turned, held out the palm of one hand, and bowed slightly in his direction. "Patricia, this is Gary Lanier, the closest thing to a civilian boss we have. Gary, Miss Patricia Luisa Vasquez." He shook his head and blew his breath out with an enthusiastic "Woo!" Lanier shook Vasquez's hand. She was small and pretty in a fragile way. Round face, silky dark brown hair, thin wrists, narrow legs, broad hips for her size. An altogether unpractical-looking woman, he thought. Beneath wide square eyes as black as his own and a small sharp nose, she had drawn her mouth into a tight line. She looked scared. "My pleasure," Lanier said. "Larry, what have you told her so far?" Heineman parried the question with a sidelong glance. "Patricia, I'm only a blue badge for now, and I hear you're going to get a green.
Gary is worried I might pass along some of the ignorant suppositions of an Axis hugger. I've only been telling her about this level of operations, I swear. He held up his right hand and clapped his left to his chest. Gary, I've read some of this lady's papers in a half dozen math and physics journals. She's fantastic. There was a question on his face, however, which Lanier had no trouble interpreting. What in hell is she doing here? So I've heard. He pointed at the cocoon. What's that? My ticket to a green badge, finally, Heinemann said. Packing slips say it's the tube rider. And the V-stole is coming in on the next OTV, a few hours from now. Then let's get it unwrapped and see what sort of modifications we'll have to make. Right. Pleased to meet you, Patricia. Heinemann started to leave, then stopped and turned back slowly with a puzzled expression. What you write about, it's really more a hobby for me, way beyond my expertise. He raised his eyebrows hopefully. Maybe we can talk more later, though, when I get my green badge? Patricia smiled and nodded. Teams of men and women in gray jumpsuits were already gathering around the cocoon like ants tending a queen. Heinemann joined them, calling out orders. Miss Vasquez, Lanier began.
Patricia's fine, really. I'm not very formal.
Neither am I, if I can help it. I'm the science team coordinator.
So Mr. Heinemann told me. I have so many questions. Mr. Lanier, Gary, is this really a spaceship? A starship? The whole thing?
She swung her arm wide, her feet lifting from the deck momentarily. It is, he said, feeling the familiar, peculiar pleasure. Even though the stone had nearly driven him crazy in the past few years, with its endless layers of surprise and shock, he was still more than a little in love with it.
Where did it come from?
Lanier held up his hands and shook his head. Vasquez suddenly noticed how exhausted he appeared, and that subdued her excitement some. First, I'm sure you'll want to rest and get cleaned up. Our facilities in the valley, the chamber floor, are quite nice. Then you can visit our cafeteria, meet a few of the team scientists, take it from there, one step at a time. Vasquez examined him intently. Her eyes made the inspection seem less than sympathetic, even aggressive.
Is something wrong?
Lanier raised his brows and glanced to one side. We have a name for what this place does to you. We call it getting stoned. I'm just a little stoned, is all. She looked around the staging area and experimented with the centrifugal force, pushing herself up a few centimeters with a nudge of her toe.
It looks so familiar, she said. I expected an alien artifact to be mysterious, but I can identify almost everything, like it was built on Earth, by us.
Well, said Lanier, Heinemann and his people have been busy up here, but keep an open mind. If you'll follow me, we'll descend to the floor of the first chamber. Use the ropes. And if Larry hasn't already said it, allow me to welcome you to the stone. Chapter 3 Patricia lay on the air mattress, keeping still so the synthetic fiber sheets wouldn't squeak against the vinyl. Surrounded by darkness, she was clean, warm, well-fed. The cafeteria food had been more than palatable. And now that she wasn't walking around, not nearly so breathless. Tired, but unable to sleep. Her memory kept tossing up visions. The 30-kilometer-wide chamber floor, a mottled gray and brown valley landscape, capped at each end by impassive rock and natural metal walls, run through by the glowing plasma tube. The peculiar perspective as she stood outside the valley level zero elevator entrance, facing the immensity, the landscape for kilometers around looking flat and normal, a desert on a bright cloudy day. Off to either side, however, spin-wise and counter-spin-wise, the curve became more pronounced. She seemed to stand under a vast arching bridge, with the plasma tube, a bright milky river, flowing overhead. Directly north, the land rose to curve in snug conformity with the circular cap. Looking up, everything distorted as if seen through a fisheye lens, the cap accepted the embrace of the opposite side of the chamber, completing the circle behind the plasma tube. The stone was still active, even though these chambers had been deserted centuries before. Lanier hadn't answered many questions, telling her it was the process to let her see and experience the stone step by step,
Otherwise, he had said, why should you believe what we tell you? That made sense, but she was still frustrated. What was so mysterious? The stone was magnificent and startling, but not, so far as she could tell, anything to arouse her professional interest. Straightforward physics, however advanced. It was simple, really. Take one large asteroid, rock with a core of nickel iron, your average millennia-old chunk of primordial planet stuff, and push it into an orbit around your planet. Hollow out 7 chambers, each connected by an axial borehole, then wormhole some of the remaining volume with tunnels, access ways, storage depots, and elevators. Bring up supplementary carbonaceous and ice volatiles asteroids and begin transferring their material into the chambers. Send it on a journey into deepest space and voila, the stone. She had learned a few key facts so far. Each chamber floor was connected by tunnels dug through the intervening asteroid material. Many of the tunnels were part of an extensive train transport system. There were no trains in the first chamber because it had served as a reserve and storage area and had been infrequently visited in the time when the stone was populated. The 7th chamber had apparently served a similar purpose, which made sense, the outermost chambers doing double duty as buffers against damage to the comparatively thin ends of the asteroid. The wall between the first chamber cap and space was only a few kilometers thick in places. But there was something peculiar about the 7th chamber. She had felt it in Lanier's voice and seen it in the expressions of those she had met in the cafeteria. And there had been the rumors on Earth. Somehow, the 7th chamber was different, important. She had met 5 team scientists so far, 3 in the cafeteria. Robert Smith, tall and bird-boned, with red hair and down-angled eyes that made him seem sad, an expert on asteroid formation. Hua Ling, the slender and intense senior member of the Chinese team, and a plasma physicist who spent most of his time at the South Polar borehole. And Lenore Carrollson, a round-faced woman of 50 with gray-blonde hair and a permanently friendly, sensual expression, heavy-lidded eyes surrounded by smile lines. Carrollson had greeted Patricia with motherly solicitude. It had taken Patricia several minutes to realize that this was the Lenore Carrollson, Nobel laureate, the astrophysicist who had discovered and partly explained gem stars 8 years before. Carrollson had taken Lanier's hint that it was her duty to show Patricia the women's quarters in the compound. They were in a long fiber wall barracks on the north end of the quadrangle. The rooms were small and spare, but comfortable in their own ingenious ways. Everything lightweight and compact. In the building's lounge, Carrollson had introduced her to 2 other astronomers, Janice Polk and Beryl Wallace, both from the Able Array in Nevada. They sprawled on couches that looked as if they had been assembled out of scrap metal in a high school shop class. Polk resembled a fashion model more than Patricia's image of an astronomer. Even in a jumpsuit, her dark beauty was elegant and distant, her expression not so much disapproving as skeptical. Wallace was attractive enough, but about 20 pounds overweight. She seemed perturbed about something. Carrollson had pointed out the social roster located near the main door. There are 30 women here on the science team and 60 men, 2 married couples, 4 committed, 5, Patricia had added, and 6 married but spouses back on Earth. I'm one of those. That means slim pickings for the single men. But, committed or not, you're fair game if you put your name on the roster. There's an old saying that has to be bent a bit here. Don't dip your pen in the office ink. Since office ink is all there is, some pen dipping is inevitable. But nobody has to take abuse. Carrollson glanced at Polk and Wallace. Right, girls? Paradise, Polk said flatly, looking up from her slate and widening her eyes. Better than university. Any trouble, Carrollson said, and you just tell me. I'm senior female here, in age at least. I'll do fine, Patricia had replied. She had never been a social butterfly, tending to fall hard and fast, and usually without reciprocation. Still with Paul to think of, that was the least of her concerns here. Although, and she smiled in the darkness, Lanier was a pretty fella. So worried, though. Patricia wondered if she would look just as worried when she had the whole picture. Without knowing she had slept, she heard the chiming alarm on her comm line. Beside her bed, a pleasant amber light switched on with the signal. She blinked at the bare off-white walls and had no trouble remembering where she was. She felt right at home, in fact, and a little excited. She swung her feet over the edge of the bed. Patricia had never been adventurous. Hiking and camping had not been missing from her life, but she had never felt inclined toward outdoor activities other than bicycling. Every 6 to 8 months, she became an avid bicyclist, spending 2 hours each day riding around the campus. The urge would pass after several weeks, and her sedentary habits would return. There had always been too much to do in her mind, or on paper. The mind work could be done almost anywhere, but not while climbing precarious trails or being dead tired after a long march. But here... Sometime in the night, she had made the stone her meat and drink. She was familiar with the feeling, having approached math problems with similar zeal. She was exhilarated, her pulse was up, and she colored like a young girl. When Lanier knocked, she had dressed and combed her hair. She opened the door with eyes wide. Carrollson stood behind him. "Breakfast?" Lanier asked. Wearing the standard zipper and button blue jumpsuit of the science team, she looked more practical, he thought. The clear, pale light of the plasma tube never varied and cast only the vaguest of shadows beneath their feet as they walked. The cafeteria, adjacent to an experimental agricultural station, was feeding breakfast to the 1500 to 2400 shift. Night, for Patricia, had been from 6 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon. Lanier said he slept irregularly. Carrollson was just finishing her shift. About 20 of the science team clustered around a video screen at one end of the cafeteria. Lanier joined them briefly, then came back while Carrollson and Patricia sat down with dinner and breakfast. An automatic chef produced trays of food, each segment at the proper temperature, each dish surprisingly tasty. A tap near the unit carried a sign announcing, "Genuine stone water, an experience not to be missed, H2O from the stars." The water was flat, but not unpleasant. Lanier gestured at the group around the screen. "Football," he explained. "Hunt and Thon have patched into the borehole microwave and the outside array. Some commercial outfit is relaying a scrambled game to subscribers, and we happen to be in the same section of the sky as the satellite. They've unscrambled the signal." "Isn't that illegal?" Patricia asked casually, sorting out the bites on her tray. "Height hath its privileges," Carrollson said. "Nobody will ever prosecute." Fresh orange juice was available. Citrus trees prospered under the tube light. The maple syrup on her pancakes was also genuine, but not homegrown. Lanier noticed her expression of surprise. "What we can't grow in the stone, we might as well ask for the best from Earthside. It's so expensive to ship up anyway, quality only hikes at a fraction of a percentage point. And we have them convinced we should be fed at least as well as submariners and lunar settlers. Eat hearty. That's a $200 breakfast." Carrollson chatted amiably through the meal, talking about her husband's work on Earth. He was a mathematician employed by the U.S. Office of Science and Technology. Lanier said little. Patricia was also quiet, taking her cues from him, watching him from the corner of her eye whenever she thought no one would notice. His Indian features attracted her, but the dark circles under his eyes made him look as if he hadn't slept in weeks. "Really good for you," Carrollson was saying. Patricia regarded her blankly. "The tube light, you know," Carrollson reiterated. "Has everything we need and nothing harmful. You could lie out under it for days and not be burned, but you'd get your share of vitamin D." "Oh," Patricia said. Carrollson sighed. "Gary, you're having that effect again." Lanier seemed puzzled. "What effect?" "Look at the girl." Carrollson drummed her fingers on the lightweight metal table, rigged out of OTV tank baffles, as was so much furniture in the compound. "Watch out for him, Patricia. He's a heartbreaker." Patricia glanced between them, mouth open. "What?" "I'm going off ship now," Carrollson said, picking up her tray. "Just keep it in mind. Every woman on the team has had their lets for Gary, but he's responsible to someone back home, someone very important." She smiled mysteriously and walked toward the dishwasher unit. Lanier sipped his cup of coffee. "I'm not sure she's reading you correctly."
"She most certainly is not."
"She means
I'm responsible to the advisor, to Judith Hoffman.
I met her, Patricia said.
And I'm not on the social roster because there's too much work to do here and not nearly enough time. Besides, there's rank to consider. He finished the cup and set it down.
You'd think with so many intelligent people around, rank wouldn't be that much of a factor, Patricia said.
She felt naive the instant the last word was out of her mouth. Lanier folded his hands on the table and looked at her directly until she glanced away. Patricia, you're young, and this might seem very romantic to you, but it's deadly serious. We're working under agreements which took years to iron out, if they're ironed out even yet. We're an international team of scientists, engineers, and security forces, and whatever information we find is not necessarily going to be available to every person on the globe, not for some time yet. Since you'll have access to almost everything, you must be particularly responsible as I am. Please don't waste your time concerning yourself with... Well, I suggest you stay off the social roster. Another time, another place, sure, romance and adventure, but not on the stone. She sat stiffly, hands knotted in her lap. I have no intention of going on the roster, she said. She hadn't been called on the carpet exactly, but she was still upset. Good. Let's get your green badge and take a ride across the valley. They deposited their trays in the scrubber and left the cafeteria. Lanier walked a few steps ahead of her, eyes on the ground as they approached a small building near the northern side of the ramparts. A stocky, broad-shouldered woman in a black jumpsuit, with a green belt and red sergeant's stripes on her sleeve, opened the door for them, then sat behind a desk made of more baffle metal to fill out forms. When they were done, she opened a locked box and pulled out a green badge with an outline of the stone printed in one corner, surrounded by a silver circle. Our security is tight here, Miss Vasquez, she said. Make sure you know the rules. A green badge is a great responsibility. Patricia took the indelible pen and signed the badge, then pressed her fingers onto an ID scan plate for storage in the security system computers. The woman clipped the badge to her breast pocket. Pleased to have you with us. I'm Doreen Cunningham, head of security for First Chamber Science Compound 1. Any questions or problems, feel free to visit. Thank you, Patricia said. Lanier led the way out of the guardhouse and up the rampart steps. End of Side 1.